In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear part of a fantastic interview with Dr. Richard Fleming testifying under oath about how the engineered pandemic and related solutions are a deliberate attack on humanity. Dr. Fleming is a physicist, a nuclear cardiologist, a biologist, chemist, psychologist, and more. Dr. Fleming started his doctorate scientific training at the age of 12 through a program established by the JFK administration. Dr. Fleming is also the author of the recently published book titled, Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon? Before we hear this, let's listen to a few presentations from a person named Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. Dr. Harari is the top advisor to Klaus Schwab. In these excerpts, we get a perspective of what has and is being planned and put into place for the future of humanity. This connects with the research of Alison McDowell. Let's have a listen.
It will really become possible to hack not just my smartphone and email, but to hack my brain, to gather immense amounts of data on my body, on my brain, and to hack that. And to prepare for this kind of world, which is coming sooner, I think, than many people realize, we need an antivirus for the brain, for the mind. Even today, you think about something like fake news. Fake news basically uses our own weaknesses against us. If the hackers, if the bots, they discover by monitoring you that you already have a bias against a particular group of people. So they will show you fake news about that particular group because you have an irresistible urge to click on it. What did they do this time? And you will easily believe the fake news because you have this pre-existing bias. So I want an antivirus for the brain that serves me, not some corporation, that also gets to know me and knows that I have this bias against this group and warns me, watch out, you are being manipulated. And maybe even be authorized to block these kinds of manipulations. Because, you know, we should come to terms, I think, with the fact that we, as a human being, I know very little about myself. I have this notion, this illusion of free will, that I completely control my life, my decisions, my opinions, I know myself, I control my life, and that's not the case. So much of our opinions and decisions are the result of processes within us and outside us that we don't understand. And we need help in this era of protecting ourselves from these new kinds of manipulation. You can really summarize 150 years of biological research since Charles Darwin in three words. Organisms are algorithms. This is the big insight of the modern life sciences. That organisms, whether viruses or bananas or humans, they are really just biochemical algorithms. And we are learning how to decipher these algorithms. Now, when the two revolutions merge, when the infotech revolution merges with the biotech revolution, what you get is the ability to hack human beings. And maybe the most important invention for the merger of infotech and biotech is the biometric sensor that translates biochemical processes in the body and the brain into electronic signals that a computer can store and analyze. And once you have enough such biometric information and enough computing power, you can create algorithms that know me better than I know myself. And humans really don't know themselves very well. This is why algorithms have a real chance of getting to know ourselves better. We don't really know ourselves. In 10 or 20 years, when an algorithm can tell any teenager exactly where he or she is on the gay-straight spectrum, and even how malleable this position is. The algorithm tracks your eye movements, your blood pressure, your brain activity, and tells you who you are. Now, maybe you personally wouldn't like to make use of such an algorithm.
Those were excerpts of presentations by Dr. Yuval Harari, who is the top advisor to founder of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. Let's go now to hear parts of the interview with Dr. Richard Fleming.
Impressive 90-page resume. I'm not going to go through that, but very briefly, are you a medical doctor?
Yes, I am.
So therefore, you have an MD degree, as it's known.
I do, yes.
And what is your area of specialty?
Nuclear cardiology, cardiology and internal medicine.
And you also belong to professional medical associations?
Yes, I do.
Are you a fellow of the American College of Physicians?
Yes.
And are you a fellow of the American Society of Internal Medicine?
Yes.
And you also hold a PhD?
Yes, I do.
And in what field?
Physics.
And you also have a law degree, otherwise known as a JD?
I do.
And are you an inventor in the medical field?
Yes.
And very briefly, can you explain the type of medical inventions that you've invented?
The ability to image the body and determine what types of disease processes are going on by looking at metabolism and blood flow.
And do you hold patents for your inventions?
Yes, I do.
Is it fair to say you're familiar with the world of medical patents?
Yes.
You have the ability to read and interpret medical patents?
Yes, I do.
And are you also an author of professional papers?
Yes, sir.
And approximately how many?
Somewhere between 400 and 500.
And you also serve on the editorial board of professional journals?
On editorial boards and review boards for the journals.
And briefly, what does a reviewer in a professional journal do?
The obligation is when somebody submits a paper for publication for reviewers to take a look at that material, to determine if it's scientifically valid, to determine if it makes a difference in the field, and to make recommendations back to the editorial board about whether the paper should be accepted or revised or rejected for publication.
Are you prepared to testify under oath here today that COVID-19 is a bioweapon?
Yes, I am.
You wrote a book posing the question, is COVID-19 a bioweapon, correct?
Correct. The function of the book was to provide information that the general public could look at and also to provide evidence for the legal system and the medical system to understand the gain-of-function research that's been carried out over a couple decades, to show where the monies came from, to show what papers were published, showing what types of gain-of-function research occurred, and to show the patents, to clearly lay out 2 decades worth of work that's been conducted, funded primarily by the United States, although other countries have been involved, and to show how there's no evidence that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, no evidence to show that it's naturally occurring, no animal model for it, and to show the type of research that's been done with coronaviruses, funded by the U.S., supported by NIAID, NIH, Department of Defense, monies that went to Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, to Ralph Burrick at the University of North Carolina, to Qizheng Li at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and to several other universities around the country, including in the state of Texas.
Did you also look at the genetic code of the SARS-CoV-2 virus and especially the spike protein?
We did, as well as Professor Luc Montagnier, who is the gentleman who discovered the HIV virus, and several other individuals that we note in the book.
And based on that review of the genetic code, that informed your conclusion that this is a bioweapon?
Right. So the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty states that any adjustment or modification of a biological agent like this virus that doesn't provide a benefit for mankind is a biological weapon. These particular changes in this virus, including the PRRA insert, which are amino acids that were inserted that are very critical for the furin cleavage site for this virus to infect, the insertion sites that were made with HIV and simian or ape-like HIV equivalent viruses, the prion-like domain at the top of the spike protein, as well as the HIV glycoprotein 120 insert that Shizhang Li put in early on that's critical for the attachment of this virus to cells, all of which are not naturally occurring.
So to be clear, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, otherwise known as COVID-19, and especially its spike protein, is not something that's simply involved on its own in nature.
We've looked at all the different coronaviruses that exist on the planet. None of them have the PRRA insert. None of them have this tremendous amount of HIV insert. None of them have a regional binding domain that is a prion-like binding domain, which means that where it attaches to the cells, it's a prion-like domain, and prions are things that are abnormal proteins that cause other proteins to become abnormally folded.
So, to be clear, genetic changes were made to the spike protein in a lab to create what is known as the COVID-19, correct?
That's what all the data shows.
Your book references research in 2010 by Shizhang Li, who's often called the Bat Lady. Was that research designed to determine how to increase the spike protein binding capacity to the human ACE2 receptor?
So that was her goal of that research, was to increase the ability of the virus to infect human cells.
Now, interestingly, I think in this published research, they discovered that the naturally occurring spike protein from horseshoe bats was unable to bind to the human ACE2 receptors.
Right, that's exactly right.
So as of 2010, scientists, including Shizhang Li in Wuhan, China, knew that naturally occurring horseshoe bat coronavirus spike proteins could not infect humans.
That's right.
Based on your testimony, it sounds like you discovered at least two man-made inserts into the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein genetic code that prove it was produced in a lab.
Right. The research papers that Shizhang Li and Barrick and others published, they were very clear and somewhat proud of the fact that they'd been able to modify the virus and to insert changes into it that made it more infective and potentially more dangerous.
Is there some laboratory mechanism where they're able to take genetic code from elsewhere and put it into a virus?
Right. So you can actually build anything if you know what the structures are. It's like building a car. If you know what the parts are, you simply put it together. Many of the research studies that we have pointed out, they took bits and pieces of one virus, combined it with bits and pieces of another virus. If you go and look at those papers, you'll also find that they were very specific by inserting 5 nucleotide base pairs in there. So they simply switched the base pairs, and that will result in a different amino acid being added and a different protein.
Let's talk about the first insert that you found in the SARS-CoV-2 virus that led you to conclude that it was a man-made bioweapon. The first one I think you refer to is the furin cleavage PRRA insert, correct?
That's correct.
And can you explain briefly what that is?
Okay, so that's 4 amino acids that were put in. When this virus attaches, and I know this is long and complicated because a lot of people have heard of ACE2, which is one of the receptors, but it's a multi-step process. The HIV glycoprotein 120 insert, which was the second one we talked about, is required to attach to what's called a sialic acid receptor raft that stabilizes it and puts it in position. The virus then comes into contact with the ACE2 receptor. That then undergoes a change with something called a TMPRSS2 receptor, which is critical to understanding because that begins the process of bringing that virus into the cell. It then has to undergo furin cleavage at the furin cleavage site, and that's the PRRA, which makes it particularly infective for human cells. And then it comes across also something known as the neuropilin 1 receptor, which is found in the brain.
How did you discover that this PRRA furin cleavage insert had been made to SARS-CoV-2?
All you have to do is the nucleotide base sequencing, which is how we know all the variants occur. And when you do that, you find this PRRA insert.
Now, this genetic code for the furin cleavage insert, the PRRA, is that found in any other coronavirus in nature?
None.
It's not found in any other coronavirus that exists in the wild?
Right. There's absolutely no other coronavirus that has this PRRA insert. And that's 12 nucleotide bases, not a single base like sickle cell, but 12 specific nucleotide bases to provide for four amino acids that very specifically is connected with the furin cleavage site, which the U.S. government owns the patent on.
So the fact that this insert and this genetic sequence for this insert is not found in any other coronavirus in nature, what did that tell you?
Well, since mutations occur one nucleotide base at a time, you would have to come up with some phenomenal explanation for why 12 nucleotide bases suddenly inserted themselves into a virus that none of it, the other viruses in that category have. The original premise that was put forward and actually published in The Lancet was that this was a naturally occurring virus with an animal host that got transmitted to people, but yet there's not been a single animal model found with this. Neither has there been a single coronavirus that has this PRRA insert.
You mentioned the second insert, an HIV glycoprotein.
Right.
So are you saying that sections of the genetic code for HIV were inserted into the SARS-CoV-2 virus?
Yeah, Shi Zeng Li published this early on many years ago, where she was very proud of the fact that she did this. She used an HIV pseudovirus to do it. And we also know that HIV glycoprotein 120 is a prion.
So this is the HIV that became famous in the 80s and 90s. It's that HIV.
Right.
And somebody took pieces of the genetic code of HIV and put it into SARS-CoV-2?
That's what Shi Zeng Li admitted to in publications that she had, yes.
Were you able to discover why that was done?
According to the papers that she published, it was to increase the infectivity to see if she could make it more infective. But it's even clearer that what she was going for was the development of a prion disease, because where everybody is kind of coming up to speed with a virus and how challenging it can be to deal with, what's even more challenging to deal with are prions, because prion diseases are relatively new in our understanding for treatment, and they cause permanent damage unless they can be reversed. And so the development of a prion, putting HIV glycoprotein 120 in there, attaching to the sialic acid receptor, there's nothing about that that is advantageous for people. And the ability to produce prion diseases is quite a weapon.
And how lethal are prion diseases?
People die from prion diseases.
Is this process of inserting these amino acids to increase the infectivity, is that gain of function?
Right. So gain of function is anything that you do that changes a naturally occurring biological agent like this virus. And so the premise of gain of function really has a good premise behind it. The original idea being that if you could stay a step ahead of a potential infectious agent, say a coronavirus, if you could stay just a step ahead, you could do a good job of providing treatments for people and knowing when and where it was going to spread. This isn't a step ahead. This isn't a single nucleotide base. This is a spike protein that has an HIV glycoprotein 120 insert into it. This is a spike protein that has four amino acids to make a furin cleavage site, the PRRA insert. This is a spike protein that has multiple other, according to Luc Montagnier, HIV and SIV inserts. This is not something that evolutionarily evolved. The evolution of something with this many changes would take hundreds or thousands of years. This is not staying a step ahead of it. And making this provided no advantage for human beings, which makes it a Biological Weapons Convention treaty violation. It's playing God.
To your knowledge, has anyone been able to disprove or refute the fact that there are artificial man-made insertions into the SARS-CoV-2 virus?
Actually, there's been no dispute of that, except for the statement that it's naturally occurring. And then when you say, well, where's the scientific evidence that it's naturally occurring, there's no follow-up to that. So that for people that are claiming that this is a scientific discussion, I would encourage them to stay with the fact that this is a scientific discussion. There's no science to show that any other coronavirus on the planet has these inserts. There's no science to show that there's a natural reservoir or an animal for this virus to occur. In fact, the science points to the fact with over 99% probability, which is what we're dealing with until somebody comes up and confesses, that this is not naturally occurring.
And in your mind, is there any doubt that without this gain-of-function manipulation of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, there would have been no pandemic?
We wouldn't have had this had this virus not been released.
Have any of these folks, Daszak, Barrick, Xi Jinping, Fauci, explained what that beneficial alleged effect is?
Well, up until now, it seems like most of their conversation has been, we didn't do anything like that, even though the data is now showing it. But as we, as we've learned over the last couple months, the National Institutes of Health and National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease have now admitted, not that they needed to, but it's nice for them to admit that a gain-of-function research was funded for by the U.S., and that Fauci's statements that they weren't involved in gain-of-function research was not correct.
Dr. Fauci testified under oath to Congress under questioning by Senator Rand Paul that the NIH and NIAID had not funded gain-of-function research. Was that statement truthful?
Well, as we've shown and as we've talked about, that was a lie.
And that lie can be proven by publicly available documents?
Dr. Fauci denied under oath that they provided any gain-of-function research, despite the fact that we have a long track record of gain-of-function research. In fact, that gain-of-function research even occurred during the time that it was shut down during the Clinton administration due to concern by scientists like myself that saw problems with infections getting out from gain-of-function research. That money still got funneled around primarily through Peter Daszak, to whom it got funneled out to Barrick and Xi Jinping and other sources. And they're denying that they're connected with each other. Just completely goes in the face that they have published papers where both of their names, Barrick's and Xi Jinping's, are on there. You can find the publications that show NIH funding. I mean, this was not a well hidden secret. NIH has now come out since with a statement admitting that they have provided gain-of-function research.
And part of this gain-of-function was designed to make bat coronavirus spike proteins infectious to humans when they were not before.
It's very clear from the research grants that were paid for by the United States, from the published papers that Xi Jinping and the others have published, by the patents that have been published, that they specifically set out to increase and made possible the ability of these viruses to infect, particularly with the HKU4 and the HIV pseudovirus glycoprotein 120 inserts that Xi Jinping and the others were involved with, that they intentionally sought to make this more infectious and, in fact, accomplished it.
And who were the main players in these genetic engineering experiments?
Well, the primary ones that we know of are Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, and Xi Jinping at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But we know that there's been other individuals involved. We know that other universities, including here in Texas.
How were you able to uncover this gain-of-function research and who funded it?
There were a lot of very interesting sources that were coming forth suggesting places to look. But basically what I did is what any researcher does when they ask a question, which is if you know what question to ask, you can get a wealth of information if somebody has it out there. So I began querying the federal funding sources, specifically looking at EcoHealth and gain-of-function research. And that allowed me to run down the actual grant numbers. So what we have in the book, you don't have to take my word for it, is the actual grant numbers, how much monies there were, whether it came from the Department of Defense, which, by the way, paid for more than half of this.
And did you discover there were attempts to cover up the funding of this gain-of-function research?
Well, there were a lot of attempts, not very good ones as far as I'm concerned, but including the Lancet letter where, you know, Daszak and so many others got together and then published that this was obviously a naturally occurring virus, doing everything imaginable to skew the scientific medical literature to get people to not consider the possibility of it being a gain-of-function, lab-oriented bioweapon.
And did this research violate any treaties or laws?
The Biological Weapons Convention Treaty is very specific. It states that any bacterial agent, in this case a virus, that does not have a benefit for humanity is a violation of the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty. And it's important to note that this is a treaty that the United States has signed and ratified. Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution states that treaties are the supreme law of the land. The signing and ratification of the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty, the signing and ratification of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the United States participating in the Nuremberg trials of 1947 to establish the Nuremberg Code and how patients would be treated, the Declaration of Helsinki that the U.S. has committed to for research patients, the American Medical Association Code of Ethics on informed consent, that anybody violating these have already demonstrated that they not only are interested in providing informed consent and patient rights, but if they're violating a treaty, they have violated the U.S. Constitution. And anybody who has taken an oath of office, anybody who has stood there and sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, who then ignores these treaties, funds these treaties, funds violation of these treaties, as was done in this instance, who refuses to allow patients to have informed consent, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, if you've done that, you have violated the U.S. Constitution. And if you've taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, then you have committed treason.
When you reached the conclusion that SARS-CoV-2 was a bioweapon released on the planet, what was your reaction?
Uncomfortable and disappointed. If you look at the emergency use authorization documents, the documents submitted to the FDA, you have to ask yourself two questions. And the data is right in the EUA documents. The first question is, how many people get sick? And that's this number that we talk about, vaccine efficacy. How many people get sick if they're vaccinated versus how many people get sick if they weren't vaccinated? So that's this vaccine efficacy number. But if you ask the question, why are people getting vaccinated? That's not why they're getting vaccinated. They're getting vaccinated so they don't get sick. And that's called an absolute risk reduction. And if you go to the EUA documents for Pfizer, Moderna, Janssen, the three that are EUA approved in the U.S., and you ask that fundamental question, how many people do not get sick? For Pfizer, that using their data, there's no statistically significant reduction in COVID cases for vaccinated people versus unvaccinated. If you look at Moderna, the same thing. No statistical reduction in COVID cases for the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. Janssen did a little bit more complex. They looked at results at 2 weeks, 14 days after their injection, and 28 days or 4 weeks. Now, if you look at their data at 2 weeks after the injection, there is a statistical reduction in the number of COVID cases. If you carry that out 2 more weeks, which they did, that difference is gone. There's no, so if you want to vaccinate people, I guess every 2 weeks, go for it. It doesn't prevent you from getting infected. Statistically, it didn't reduce the number of COVID cases or deaths, and it doesn't prevent you from transmitting it. And that's what we're seeing right now. No virus comes in just one flavor, if you will. Just like if you look around a room, you'll see a whole bunch of people and they're all variants, but they're all very much human, right? So SARS-CoV-2 didn't just come as Wuhan HU1. It had the alpha and the beta and the gamma and the lambda and the delta and all the other variants, all the different changes. And what we've done in the past is we've taken and made vaccines by taking all of the parts of a virus with all of the variants and weakening it and then injecting that into people so that if you saw another version of it or other parts of it, you would have an immune response to it. What we did with these vaccines is we very specifically said, let's just look at the spike protein of the original one, the one called Wuhan HU1, and let's make that genetic code and turn the human cells into a manufacturing plant to make those spike proteins. Well, what did that do? For the people who got vaccinated, many of them who did it because they were worried about other people. So understanding that these people were well-intentioned. They were afraid. They were fearful. They didn't want somebody else to get sick because of them. They didn't want other family members to become sick. They didn't want the man or the woman down the street who had cancer or heart disease to become sick. So as good citizens, they were told, you need to do this and it will make a difference. But the vaccines don't prevent you from getting infected or spreading it. So by using this approach, we injected this mRNA and DNA into people for just one type of spike protein, not the rest of the virus, not the nucleocapsid, which turns out to be what humans make the best immune response to, not the envelope, not the membrane, and not the other types of spike protein. One type. And so what we see is people getting vaccinated with it. And if you track what's happened, not only in the United States, but around the world, as these vaccines have been used, fewer and fewer people have gotten infected with the Wuhan HU1, or if they've gotten infected, they were ready for it. But they weren't ready for the other variants, the alpha, the beta, the gamma, the delta, the mu, the now Omicron, as people like to call it, what I call 21K, but Omicron is now the term for it. Those, they didn't have an immune response to. So they responded to it rapidly, and then when they spread the virus to other people, they spread the ones that weren't attacked because the immune system wasn't ready for it. So we've done a great job of pressure selecting out this virus to the variants so that we're spreading and shifting it. And now the spike protein of Omicron is so much different than even Delta or Alpha or HU1 that the ability of our immune system to respond to that isn't there. And we're seeing more and more people with this variant coming down with symptoms and spreading it to other people. When you ask to have the vaccines done a good job of reducing this, all you have to do is look at the science. All you have to do is look at the numbers. Israel vaccinated the vast majority of its country with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and their cases of Delta escalated right off the chart as a result of it. They simply did pressure selection. In the United States, we've done the same thing, where we're seeing the Omicron variant and the Delta variants being pressure selected out by this vaccine program. This has not helped reduce it. It simply shifted the variants and persisted the problem and stressed people and made people afraid.
In this case, if you look at the data, the difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated on an absolute risk reduction standard was statistically insignificant.
The absolute risk reduction is somewhere between 0.8 and 1.3%.
And that was known by the FDA and the drug manufacturers before these vaccines were rolled out.
What bothers me, I mean, I watched these FDA meetings for the EUA, and none of the people on the panel raised the question, what's the absolute risk reduction, which is the goal of actually vaccinating people. I watched the FDA meetings for the booster shots, and I don't remember whether it was Pfizer or Moderna. I want to say it was Moderna, but I won't swear to it. The head of their vaccine project said that T-cell response was unimportant. Well, T-cell response is critical because you have T-cells and B-cells, and it refers to where they come from. But the T-cell response, it's called innate immunity, is critical, and it's the first thing that happens to people. The B cells or antibody responses occur several days later. But for the antibody response to occur, the T cells have to be working. And we know from published data, and I've provided documents on this, that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines suppress the T cell response in people that get the vaccine. Not only does the count of those cells go down, but the chemicals that they produce, interferon, which simply means it interferes with the production of viruses, and what's called T helper 2 cells, which are a type of T cell that's critical to help make the right antibody response, all of that is suppressed in individuals who get these vaccines. Listening to people tell me that they're Mr. Science, or Big Pharma saying that it's all about the science, or anybody else saying it's all about the science, I'm seeing a tremendous lack of actual science integrity and interrogation of the science, because when you go into the documents, the EUA documents, and you do the science, you do the interrogation of the data to see if it's really different, you discover it's not. The data is very clear. The science is very clear. The vaccines have not done anything to reduce COVID cases or deaths. Just a fundamental question. If you understand that the spike protein is a gain-of-function bioweapon, why would you then replicate that same genetic sequence and put it in a vaccine? I think most people are under the impression that you get an injection in your muscle, that it stays in your muscle, right? Except that's not what happens. The studies are very clear. The lipid nanoparticle influenza vaccine made by Moderna spread to the brain, the bone marrow, the liver, the spleen, the heart, kidneys, the intestine, every part of the animal's body. It doesn't stay at the site of injection. These things aren't being directly injected into your cells. They're being injected into muscle, which has fluid around the cells that drains out to the rest of your body and gets into your bloodstream, where it can have some very serious consequences. Some of the research that we've recently done has looked at the Pfizer, Moderna, and Janssen vaccines and what happens when they are introduced into human blood.
Now, is the introduction of the spike protein into the body through these so-called vaccines functionally different than the introduction of those spike proteins through the SARS-CoV-2 virus?
When people spread infections back and forth, they spread hundreds or thousands or, you know, if you want to be generous, 10,000 virus particles by coughing or sneezing on somebody. And so that's the amount that you would get exposed to. And that's why, you know, back in 2020, we saw so many people with the comorbidities because they already had diseases where there was inflammation and blood clotting going on. With the vaccines, those numbers are significantly different. We're not talking about thousands or tens of thousands. We're talking about billions in these vaccines. And
billions of spike proteins?
Billions of genetic sequences to make spike proteins. For Pfizer and Moderna, it's 13.1 billion. For Janssen and AstraZeneca, it's 50 billion. And the other thing is that a virus to get into your cell has to find, you know, that ACE2 receptor that we talked about. These vaccines don't. The lipid nanoparticles simply merge with your cell membrane. They don't have to look for an ACE2 receptor to get in. They simply merge with it and release all that genetic sequence in. What we're seeing with vaccinated individuals are healthy people reacting. Why? Because they're not getting exposed to 1,000 or 10,000 virus particles from somebody else who coughed or sneezed on them, which shouldn't have coughed or sneezed on them, right? They're getting billions. And if they have a functioning, healthy body, their immune system is looking at that and saying, wow, we have just been massively infected, and they mount an immune response. And that immune response has inflammation and blood clotting. You release chemicals to kill the cells that are infected. That's why you get a runny nose. That's that fluid being released. And blood clotting to wall off the invader so that it can't get out, number one, and number two, can't get nutrients in, so it dies. So that inflammation and blood clotting is what your body should do, except you don't get infected with billions of these viruses. So healthy people are reacting to something that looks like a nuclear bomb went off in their body, and they're reacting to it, producing a lot of inflammation, a lot of blood clotting, and a lot of very adverse events. And what we're seeing with all the people with adverse events are all the people that are healthy, younger, responding to what appears to be an overwhelming infection in their body with all the spike proteins, and we're seeing inflammation and blood clotting. And you've seen it with strokes and seizures and heart disease and, you know, miscarriages and deaths that we've never seen before in the history of mankind for vaccines that have been made. I remember in the 70s, mainstream media, 60 Minutes did a documentary exposing the lies by Big Pharma and the FDA on the swine flu vaccine. And at 25 deaths, we decided that something needed to be done. So it really doesn't matter to me whether it's been 15,000 deaths or 150,000 deaths. If in 1976, 25 deaths was enough to cause people to say, we need to investigate this, and in 2021, 15,000 deaths isn't enough, we have a problem.
Well, have you seen any evidence that Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna did animal studies before they went to the FDA for emergency use authorization?
I have not, and I have to tell you that all of these call for animal models to be done before you do it in a human so that you know what would happen, right? And I've done animal research for many decades of my life, and there's a reason for doing it. It's because you don't experiment on people unless you're Nazis.
And if I understand it correctly, the CDC VAERS reporting system is showing more deaths and injuries from COVID-19 vaccines than all other vaccines combined for the last 30 years.
It is. And you know, independent upon whether you believe those numbers or not, you think they're 1% or 10%, whether you should put one zero or two zeros behind the numbers, here's some interesting things about this reporting system. As a physician, I've tried to call in to the VAERS reporting system, and I get a recording that gives me another telephone number to go to. When I call that number, it gives me a recording and no place to leave a message. I have colleagues who have tried to enter it in on the computer system, and it keeps bouncing back. Now, if you come into a hospital or doctor's office and you have an adverse event to measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines, there's a code to enter into that, and it goes into the computer. If you have an adverse event to diphtheria and tetanus vaccine, there's a code for that that goes into the computer, and that will be tracked through history. These things are called computerized procedural terminology, CPT codes. There is no CPT code to enter into a computer system for an adverse event to any of these SARS-CoV-2 vaccines.
Even though this is part of a clinical trial, and therefore they have a legal obligation to track adverse events, there is no universal code for physicians to code in an adverse event?
That's right.
Have you ever seen that before?
It's the first time.
Wait a second. So these are vaccines that, as I understand it, the ones that are available are still part of a clinical trial that lasts until 2023, correct?
That's what it shows, yes, on the National Clinical Trial site.
And when you're doing a clinical trial, one of the most important things you need to do is accurately track adverse events, I would assume.
We're going to look back on this. We're going to look in not too distant in the future. We're going to look back on 2020 and 2021, 2021 in particular, and say, how many people really had an adverse event to these vaccines?
Now, have you seen any animal studies that have been produced or released by any of the current vaccine manufacturers before emergency use authorization?
I haven't seen any animal studies by those corporations before or after they've come out. The only animal studies that have been done are by independent scientists who have been asking the questions that these companies should have been asking, which is, what are the consequences in animals to these vaccines?
What has that research uncovered?
The research done by independent researchers have shown that there is damage to the brains and other body organs caused by these viruses and these vaccines that are called prion diseases. So you can have mad cow disease in the brain, or Alzheimer's in the brain, or amyloid disease in the heart, which is another type of prion disease. But the studies done by people doing the research on the animals have been very clear and very consistent. Prion diseases, inflammation and blood clotting or inflammothrombotic diseases, and real concerns about miscarriages and other health problems and deaths. None of this has been done by Pfizer, Moderna, Janssen, or the other companies.
This animal research could have been done before the emergency use authorization, but we have no record that it was ever done or reported.
This animal research should have been done. It violates every treaty and code that we've ever had as human beings. There was one instance in time that animal research was abandoned by doing it on people first. And we prosecuted those people in 1947 at the Nuremberg trials. One of the questions that we had was, what happens if the vaccine gets into your blood? We've looked at Pfizer, Moderna, and Janssen, all three, and we have looked at the effect that those vaccines have on the blood, and it's almost immediate. What we're going to look at are just three examples of slides that we took from
7 different patients and the 3 different vaccines, where we put samples of blood on a microscope slide and looked at them under the microscope. And what you're going to see here in the first image, you're going to see the Pfizer vaccine that was added to the blood. And you're going to see the nice red color of erythrocytes or red blood cells. That's because they're able to carry oxygen from the lungs to the body. And what you're going to see next to them are a lot of gray cells. These are still what's called red blood cells, although they're no longer red because they're no longer able to carry oxygen. And since there's plenty of oxygen already in the air, what we're seeing is an inability for the hemoglobin in those cells to bind oxygen. And they stay this way after many, many minutes of watching them. They didn't turn back or even begin to turn back. And in the second slide you're going to look at, we're going to see the exact same thing in another patient. This is Moderna once it's been added, and you see the same phenomenon. And then finally, the third cell is the Janssen vaccine, showing the exact same phenomenon with the loss of the ability of the hemoglobin to hold oxygen, as shown by gray cells next to the bright red cells that are still functioning, that haven't been damaged by the vaccine.
If we look at these slides, what we're seeing is that when you added the vaccine to the red blood cells, the red coloration goes away.
The red coloration goes away and it stays away. And it's not a matter of adding just a liquid to it, because we also looked at blood when we added normal saline to it, and it dilutes it out a little bit, but it doesn't take the red color away. These, all three of these vaccines, when we added them to the blood, the red color to the red blood cells goes away, which means the hemoglobin is no longer able to carry oxygen. So that could be due to a couple of things. There's no oxygen to carry. Well, it's open to the atmosphere, so there's plenty of oxygen. So it means the hemoglobin molecule has been damaged, or the membrane of the red blood cell has been damaged. But sickle cell anemia is a damaged altered red blood cell, and it has no difficulty being a red blood cell. So something's happened to the hemoglobin molecule, and it doesn't reverse. We've watched the blood for many, many minutes. It doesn't reverse. The other thing we saw is that the blood begins to clump together. And it's not a matter of time, because we watched regular blood of these same individuals with normal saline added to it, and their blood didn't clump. So it's not a time phenomenon. It's not because they were drawn up in tubes that had solutions in them that affected the red blood cells, because this blood was drawn directly from the patients, wasn't put in any tubes with any other material in it that could interfere with it. So this is a phenomenon of the vaccines get added, where the vaccines touch the red blood cells turn pale. They're no longer red. The important thing is not only the oxygen carrying capacity, but the fact that that same hemoglobin that picks up oxygen from your lungs and takes it to your body, when it's in your body, takes the carbon dioxide, the waste product out, the acid, and takes it back to your lungs. Well, if the hemoglobin has been damaged so it can't carry oxygen, that same damage exists, and it's unlikely that it's going to even be able to carry the carbon dioxide out. Although carrying the oxygen is kind of the big deal for red blood cells.
And what would be the consequences of having this depletion of the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood cells?
Well, none of those red blood cells can carry any oxygen to your body. The real question is how much of that is going on in any individual, and no amount of this vaccine, of any of these vaccines, should have damaging effect on red blood cells. Again, this is a tissue level thing. This is early on stuff. This is like the animal studies. If you're going to be looking at doing something, giving a drug to a patient, you need to know that the drug will work, and you need to know what consequences there may be. Seriously, this is an easy project to do. You take the vaccines, you take human blood, you add it to it, and if anybody can prove to me that what we saw repeatedly is wrong, hey, go for it. Prove me wrong. But yeah, you know, you're not going to, because the beautiful thing about science is that we've conducted this in more than one site on the planet, in 7 different people with all 3 vaccines. They all had the same devastating effect to the blood.
Do you have a working theory or hypothesis as to why these vaccines are causing this blood cell discoloration and clumping?
Yeah, I actually do. We've known for a long period of time that RNA or DNA when it's outside of a cell is a prion. Human red blood cells are the only cells in the human body that don't have a nucleus, and they don't have ribosomes. All they have is hemoglobin to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. So red blood cells can't do anything with genetic code that's entered into it. Now, the lipid nanoparticles would simply merge with the red blood cells. If the red blood cells behave like any other part of the body does that's outside of a cell that doesn't have a nucleus or ribosomes, when RNA or DNA comes into contact with it, it acts like a prion and changes the protein structure. Hemoglobin is a protein. So what it looks to us like is happening is these vaccines are releasing either the RNA or the DNA from the vaccine into the red blood cells, having a prion effect on the hemoglobin molecule, permanently changing the hemoglobin molecule so that it no longer has the same shape or configuration, so it can't bind oxygen and it won't be able to pick up carbon dioxide.
Dr. Fleming, are the vaccines reprogramming the innate immune system?
What we have seen is that two of the critical steps for your immune system, the production of something called interferon, which means it interferes with the replication of the virus, and T helper 2 cells, which are critical for helping to make antibodies, those are all suppressed. Now, T helper 2 cells, I know, is a term people haven't heard. It's a type of T cell. It helps, and it's number 2 in the sequence. It has 3 components that actually need to match up with the B cells that make antibodies. Only when all 3 of those match up does a signal get sent to your antibody system, what's called the adaptive humoral antibody system, to make antibodies of a specific type, targeting a specific infection, and to keep memory cells for that. Now, in the absence of those T helper 2 cells being produced like they should, that system, even though it exists, is going to be blunted.
Based on all of this, would somebody be totally off base if they believe these vaccines were in and of themselves a bioweapon?
Well, the fact that the spike protein is a gain-of-function developed virus, which by definition is a bioweapon, replicating that same genetic sequence and putting it into a vaccine, it doesn't matter how you get it into the human body, it's still a bioweapon. Most alarmingly for the children right now, when you have people at an FDA meeting making a statement that we need to vaccinate the children, but we won't know what happens to them until we vaccinate them, that's the experimental phase of a research project. And as of 1947, I thought that we had officially, although it's very clear from the Tuskegee Airmen and other studies that have been done, paid for by the U.S. government, that it seems that our leaders don't have a problem experimenting on our elderly, on our police officers, on our first responders, on our doctors and nurses, on our general public, and now apparently don't have a problem experimenting on our children.
So if you were advising, for example, the Texas Health Commissioner on how to fight this attack, what would you recommend?
Well, it goes back to one of the statements I made earlier. When you're doing something in medicine and or science of any sort, and there's a bad outcome, you quit doing it. You know, if one of my medical students came up to me and said, well, Dr. Fleming, it didn't work the last few times we gave this medication to somebody, and they had a really bad outcome, but I want to try it again because maybe it'll work this time, I'd probably kick them off the rotation. We don't keep repeating the things that cause the problem. All the evidence shows there's no statistical benefit to using these vaccines. The mass vaccination has caused pressure selection of these variants. It has produced significant adverse effects in the people it's been given to. The FDA has admitted during its EUA documents for children that we won't know what it does to our children until we experiment on our children. It's very clear. These vaccines have done nothing to solve the problem. They need to be stopped. The companies need to be held legally accountable. The questions about why all these codes and treaties that we claim that we honor are being abused needs to be addressed. The gain-of-function research needs to be stopped, at least until it can be done at some point under some type of control where it actually provides a benefit for humanity without a harm. We need to hold the people accountable that have been responsible for doing this. They have violated the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty. They have violated the Nuremberg Code. They have violated the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They have violated the American Medical Association Code of Ethics, which may not be a criminal act, but it's the way I thought we were kind of practicing medicine, or we're supposed to practice medicine. There comes a time for everybody to be held accountable for things that they do. People make mistakes. I'm human. You won't have any challenges finding somebody that will tell you that I make mistakes, okay? I know I make mistakes. I'm my worst critic on a science and medical perspective. 2 decades worth of gain-of-function research, all focused on increasing the infectivity of this virus, with consequences that are very clear around the world. We took procedures in 2020 and 2021 that make no scientific sense. There's no data to show that the quarantining of citizens around the world stopped this virus. If there is, explain to me why in 2021 this virus is endemic. It didn't stop it. Physicians abandoned the practice of medicine for a variety of reasons. Some of them might have literally thought they were doing the right thing. Many of them did it because they were told there were no treatments. And who told them that? Agencies out of the federal government? The federal government, run by Fauci and Collins and other people, those agencies don't practice medicine. All the things that we did in science and medicine was thrown out the windows. We locked down a society. We put fear into everybody's heart. We told people to quit believing people who might tell you something different. We quit challenging the scientific paradigm. In science, we're always debating. Anybody who thinks that physicians and scientists are just this jolly group of people that are constantly agreeing with each other, no, scientific debate is constantly had. Physicians frequently will talk amongst ourselves and debate what should or shouldn't be done, but that's a free exchange of ideas. That hasn't been done. Texas Medical Association, health authorities, the governor, the attorney general, all of the people should be looking at why this happened to make sure that Texans are taken care of and other people in the country have an opportunity to follow. It needs to be holding accountable the people that caused this chaos, this mayhem to begin with, and stopping it from occurring again.
That was part of an interview with Dr. Richard Fleming. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. The links to this full interview will be on inothernewsradio.com.